This is Molly Smith introducing our annual Bringing America Back to Life speaker series. At this annual event, we invite those on the front lines of the pro-life and family movement to come together for a convention dedicated to exploring the full spectrum of issues and challenges that confront us as we continue to fight for the sanctity of human life, to protect our God-given family structure. We trust you will be edified and encouraged as you listen to our fine roster of speakers who by their articulate, thoughtful, expert presentations eloquently defend the right to life. It is my pleasure to introduce to you Dan Becker and Sarah Qualley. Dan is the founder and president of Personhood Alliance and past president of Georgia Right to Life. And Sarah is the founder and president of Speak Life. Sarah is an award-winning curriculum, assessment, and instructional designer and a gifted facilitator. She is passionate about unlocking the spiritual powers of learning to help people stand for life according to their unique calling. While under Dan's leadership, the Personhood approach has become the national vanguard in the pro-life movement. Their topic, practical pro-life philosophy, ideas, consequences, and a principled way forward.
Thank you, Molly Smith. It is a joy and a privilege to be here at Bringing America Back to Life. We enjoy this. We set our annual board meeting around this event. So people coming in from all over the country and now all over the world, we have our first international guest that's coming as a result. So thank you, Molly, for this tremendous venue to reinforce a wonderful change of returning to first principles. What does that mean? What does it mean to return to first principles in the pro-life movement, our strategy, our policy, and why is that needed? Well, the Personhood Alliance is one of the organizations that is gathering other groups from all over that want to end the compromise in the issue of the sanctity of life and human dignity. Marriage is certainly a part of the pro-life movement. And we changed our charter to embrace a broader perspective in the pro-life movement than currently was allowed under our National Right to Life affiliation. Personhood Alliance, Bringing America Back to Life, is a return to first principles because we are faith-based. We begin with the biblical basis for the sanctity of life and human dignity, found in Genesis. We all know the passage. But this passage establishes human exceptionalism in all of creation. It is only humans who were given the title of being God's image, God's representation in creation. And that sets us apart from everything. It becomes the basis of worth and human dignity. And we call it, from the inception, the sanctity of life, not pro-life. It's a different term. It's a different concept. It used to be called the sanctity of life back in the early days of the movement, but you've seen it change into a more pro-life, which is much broader. Our public policy objective and our purpose is to establish the legal recognition and protection of the God-given, inalienable right to life of all innocent human beings as persons at every stage of their biological development. In every country of the world, their constitution defines in that country rights and privileges of citizens. But actually, the term used in most constitutions is persons. And so personhood is a legal term that crosses international lines that describes, according to our definition, recognizing, as any government should, the inalienable right to life granted to us by our Creator. We're not asking government to define personhood. We are demanding that they recognize what God has already done. I so appreciate the fact that we are drawing Catholic faithful and evangelicals and Protestant renewals and all to a return to first principles along the line of a faith-based effort. And I particularly appreciate Pope John Paul II, Evangelium Vitae, where he said the commandment, you shall not kill, has absolute value when it refers to an innocent person. And all the more so in the case of weak and defenseless human beings who find their ultimate defense against the arrogance and caprice of others only in the absolute binding force of God's commandment. Now, what don't church leaders, Protestant, Catholic, pro-life leaders understand about the definition of the term absolute when it applies to the commandment, thou shalt not murder? It is absolute. Now, I went to Google Dictionary, and I know the definition's right because it came from Google. That absolute means cannot be qualified or diminished. Now, see, when we add that we are in favor of protecting all innocent life, that's our objective and our laws, but we qualify that a child with a fetal anomaly is not only not to be protected, but can be killed under statute of law, under the force of law. That's a violation of the absolute command of God, thou shalt not murder. What about a child based on its manner of conception? Once again, there's nothing that the child has done that is wrong, and yet we impose the ultimate death penalty upon the child and not upon the perpetrator of the heinous act of rape. So we've got things a little mixed up. My goal here today is to challenge you to think about abortion and euthanasia as different than the general accepted right now. We've had an entire generation of about 35 years where there has been a shift away from an absolute concept of the sanctity of life. Innocent human life is absolute, and it's not just the Catholics, but the largest Protestant denomination in the world, the SBC, the Southern Baptist Convention. Also, in 1988, after supporting abortion in their resolutions, changed, repented, confessed that they were wrong, and changed it to say that human life from fertilization until natural death is sacred. That means sanctified. That means set apart, holy. Human life is special from God and should be protected and not destroyed. Now, I've been doing a series here over the last number of years that ideas have consequences. What we believe, unknowingly in many cases, affect our choices, our actions. We are here today. I want to describe the problem, and I'm going to turn it over to Sarah to give us some godly solutions to how we can change our thinking in this regard. Somewhere along the way, we have lost our abhorrence for the evil of abortion, murder. We've lost our abhorrence of it as the central focus of violating an absolute command of God. Now, what we want to do is show you through, this is my presentation, I certainly won't inflict this on Sarah. I'm going to challenge you with some pro-life memes. Now, these are visual graphic images, and I'm not going to subject you to anything negative. We have children in the room, and these are all child certified. So, but they will challenge your thinking. In areas. Now, you know there's a battle going on in Mosul right now in Iraq, and it's between ISIS and the Muslim Islamic Army of Iraq, the majority Muslim army. Muslim against Muslim. One holds one set of beliefs, another holds another. Now, let's say you're living in Mosul, and you're a moderate, slightly pro-life member of ISIS, and you don't agree with the beheadings and the terrible things that are going on. And so you want to go to the leadership as a member of ISIS and register your opinion and encourage them to do the right thing. All right? We are not really going to challenge abortion as murder when you go to ISIS and you say, we want you to wait 24 hours before killing someone. Now, I appreciate my friends at American Right to Life who created these memes that I'm going to be sharing with you. Certainly, it never occurred to me, but it visualizes to you the problem. What about urging ISIS to get informed consent from a jihadist before they behead somebody? Okay, you know, that's exactly what our informed consent laws do, and it's largely the abortionist who gives permission to get the abortion in these laws. What's the problem here with these two memes? We've lost our abhorrence of the fact that the central issue is the murder of innocent people. That's what should be central to our focus. We should be stopping the killing, not merely regulating. Now, the argument, I know the argument. We're going to save lives by, you know, urging ISIS to stop killing by dismemberment. Or my personal favorite, this one right here, to anesthetize before beheading. I mean, we laugh. Father Frank Pavone, a priest for life, endorsed this very bill, first in the nation, in Montana. Now, what's the problem with it? Does it send a message that we are humane and ISIS is not? Well, that's the intent of the bill. We want a more humane death, or murder in this case. But the problem is, by pruning the leaves of abortion, we strengthen its root legally. All of these laws are on the books and will have to be overturned after Roe is returned to the states or a human life amendment is established at a constitutional level. We are not free of everything the moment that changes because of bills like this that on a state-by-state basis would have to be changed. And here's the one I want to bring to you today. It is urging ISIS to murder fewer people. Okay? Let's reduce the number of the killing. That's the goal of all incremental legislation today. Now, Georgia Right to Life, I was a president for 8 years. We involved ourselves in regulating abortion, trying to end the killing in Georgia. We sponsored a personhood amendment, human life amendment at a state level, because we wanted to shine the light educationally to the public and to the legislators at the Capitol that all innocent human life should be protected. The regulation route strengthened the root of abortion in our state, whereas a personhood effort actually shined the light on the evil of murder. Now, we went that route after a period of education. We saw our state change. Right now, today, there are only two states in the nation that have no rape and incest law exceptions in any of their pro-life law: Georgia and Michigan. Michigan was first. Georgia repented, and we turned the state around in our pro-life law. But it doesn't stop there. How many children did we save who were condemned to death in other states, including Ohio, for simply being conceived in rape or incest? We saved 100%. 100%. Can it be done? Yes, it can be done. You have not because you ask not. When we return to first principles, placing God and our faith first, then he responds and does miracles in the hearts of the king. We saw Georgia become the first state in the nation to have every single statewide elected official, governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, secretary of state, public service commissioners, insurance commissioners, superintendent of education. Every single statewide elected official became pro-life in order to get elected in the state of Georgia. Without exceptions. You hear that? Without exceptions. If you're a politician in Georgia, guess where you have to be? We can do this. And I appreciate we've got Georgia Right to Life's president right here to testify to the truthfulness of the statements that are being made here. So I'm not going to get away with anything. But the bottom line is this. I believe that we're living in a new day, a fresh day, a return, a renewal in the pro-life movement. That renewal is taking place right here in Ohio. We are so proud of what you are doing, what you have done. And this whole concept, this false concept, stems from the concern that we want the greatest good for the greatest number. How many of you have ever heard that cited to you about incremental legislation? Greatest good for the greatest number. Do you know where that comes from? It comes from a man by the name of Jeremy Bentham in the 1800s, who was a secular humanist, hated God, hated Christianity, and said, we need to replace the morality of the Ten Commandments with our own humanist morality. And the greatest good for the greatest number became the new morality of the academia, philosophers of the day, influencing Peter Singer today, who quotes the greatest good for the greatest number as the basis for all human morality. Guess who used the greatest good for the greatest number? And it wasn't originally the Nazis. It was German philosophers in the 1920s, years before Nazism took over, that justified the killing of useless eaters. The greatest good for the greatest number, limiting resources in order to kill some to save others. Now, if that is not the modus operandi of nearly all of our current pro-life law at a national level today, I don't know what is. Dustin Siggins, writing for Crisis Magazine, and I'll close with this, described an event that took place with the 20-week pain-capable bill in 2015. Remember if you were at the March for Life 2015, 2 years ago, there was a huge level of excitement because we were going to vote on the 20-week bill the day, morning of the 22nd of January, and trout it out as a wonderful accomplishment by Congress during the election year. Okay? It didn't happen. It didn't happen because of revolt of those who want to return to first principles occurring right here in Ohio. One of the groups in Ohio, Northeast Ohio Right to Life, Denise Leopold, objected to the rape and incest exceptions that for the first time in our pro-life history came out in the bill rather than being attached to it during the political process. That's the way we've always operated, with that unseen understanding that the pro-life movement, National Right to Life, AUL, Susan B. Anthony List, Father Frank Pavone, all of the inside the beltway pro-life groups would offer a clean bill and then let it be corrupted because that's the best that we can do in a fallen world. Sounds reasonable. You have not because you ask not. And this group in Ohio, with Molly's help, Paula's help, ended up, Ed Sitter, I mean, the cry went out, and it spread around the nation. We joined forces from 14 other states to absolutely barrage Congress to remove the rape and incest exceptions or kill the bill. The compromise was over. This is what Dustin said in Crisis Magazine right after the event. they, the pro-life groups, clearly missed the boat on the 20-week ban, despite telling everyone to fall into line because they supposedly knew the situation in D.C. They knew what could pass and could not, and the rest of us ought to listen to them, we were told. But as is often the case, having D.C. expertise does not always translate to electoral or policy victories. And often, compromise is the first step Beltway groups like to make rather than the last. Certainly, the H.R. 36 experience makes it clear that the D.C.-based pro-life organizations can no longer demand grassroots pro-lifers simply send checks and let them do their work. Somewhere along the way, we've lost our abhorrence to murder and the absolute command that it is wrong, and we need to end it now. Utilitarianism is a false philosophy, and I'm going to ask Sarah if she would come up, and let's examine some of the changes that can be made.
You guys hear me okay? All right. Thank you, Dan. It is a real honor and privilege to be able to share the stage with you, or the front portion of this room, maybe is a better way to say that. I'm so happy to be here again this year. I'm gonna take what Dan said, and I'm gonna go a little bit deeper with it. But before I do that, I want to really set a real solid scriptural foundation for what I'm gonna talk about. So whether or not you knew it, you entered this room to go to church this morning. So we're going to go to church for a few minutes. So everyone has probably heard the statement that Christians should be in the world, not of the world. This actually comes from John 17, and this is a prayer that Jesus was praying to the Father on the night before he was to be crucified. And he said, "I have given them your word, and the world has hated them because they are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. I do not ask that you take them out of the world, but that you keep them from the evil one. They are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. Sanctify them in truth. Your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, so I have sent them into the world." Now, his prayer wasn't that God would protect them in their huddled little corner in the culture, right? He was sending them into the world, a world that would hate them because it first hated Jesus. In other words, they had been rescued from the darkness, not to run away from the darkness, but to go into the darkness, to rescue other people. This is our call today. This, we are followers of Jesus. This is what we are commanded to do. So what are we to use as we go out into the darkness to rescue people? What is our weapon? Well, our weapon is truth, right? Our weapon is principles, the word. We know this. If we look at this same passage in a little bit different way, we see that he was also asking the Father to sanctify them in truth. That means to purify them, to set them apart, to align them with their God-given purpose through their alignment with the Word. So standing on that solid foundation must also be our call. But too often in the pro-life movement, as Dan mentioned, this doesn't happen. We're not really sure what we're standing on or what we're standing for. So in researching and observing and being involved in the pro-life movement over the last several years, what I've noticed is two major challenges to this calling, and I want to put them forward for you this morning. These are both internal to us individually and also external to the national movement, to the state-level movement as a whole. The first one The first challenge is there is a worldview that is guiding our thinking and behavior that we are unaware of. Now, this goes directly against that call to be in the world, not of the world. And the second challenge is that there is a misunderstanding and a misinterpretation of that biblical foundation. And oftentimes, there is actually a rejection of that foundation. Now, sometimes that's intentional, but most often it's unintentional. We just need to be aware of it. And that, of course, is in direct contrast to that second part of that verse, to stand on truth. Now, I think we can all agree that this is a little bit of a problem, right? We are supposed to go out into the world. We're supposed to rescue people from the darkness. But there's a worldview driving our behavior, our thinking that we don't know about, and we have some misunderstandings of the foundation that we are supposed to stand on. So the question obviously becomes, what are we going to do about this? What can we do? How do we change this? Well, education is the key. Now, that's a cliche. It's a college advertisement, right? But it really is. It really, really is true. We need to know what those philosophies are that lie underneath the worldview that's driving our thinking and behavior. We need to know what those misinterpretations are that are leading to the rejection of the foundation. But even more critical, I think, is we need to know why. Why are these things not aligned with the word? Why are they false? And why is what we're saying right? Why? So the next question is, then, where do we start? Well, I think we start, first of all, by understanding that there is a destructive thread woven throughout history that sets itself up against the Word of God. There are specific philosophies that reject absolute truth. And absolute truth really just means that there is an objective morality for all people, all times, all places that is set forth in the Bible and that is reflected in the character of God himself. We need to understand how these philosophies have come into America, how they've infiltrated all of our social and cultural institutions, and how they've brought us to where we are today into what I like to call our anti-Christian culture. Not post-Christian anymore. Anti-God. That's where we are these days. So we also need to understand how those philosophies led to the misunderstanding, the misinterpretation, that rejection of the word. And we need to understand the ways in which we have aligned ourselves with these things, oftentimes unknowingly, both in the larger movement as a whole, but also individually in our own thoughts and behaviors. Because I think the really the most important reason for this, that what and the why, combining the both, being able to talk about the why, is because when we start to expose these things, we can actually reject them in our own thinking and behavior. We can start to recognize them in the culture. It's sort of like buying a new car, right? Suddenly you're driving down the road and everybody has your car. You never noticed it before, but suddenly it's everywhere. It's sort of like that. You really have that awareness. So from that exposure, from that rejection, from that recognition, we can really help call the movement to a new standard, to ask them to return to the biblical principles in our strategies, our philosophies, our approaches to different issues of life, to be in the world, not of the world, and to stand on that solid foundation of truth. So I want to start going into a little bit of this morning. I'm going to focus on one philosophy, Dan brought it up, utilitarianism, that I think has been and will continue to be the most harmful to the pro-life movement. And then I want to get into one misinterpretation of Scripture in particular that over time has really formed a pretty big crack in our foundation. So I'm going to start with utilitarianism. Dan touched on it a little bit. The philosophy of utilitarianism, as Dan says, was first systematically developed by Jeremy Bentham. He was an English philosopher in the late 18th century, early 19th century. What Bentham said was that morality does not come from God. There's that rejection of absolute truth. But it comes from social utility, the social usefulness of particular actions and the consequences produced from those actions. And actions are right to the degree that they promote the greatest good for the greatest number. Bentham also said that the morality of an act depends on the desirability of its outcome, or how much pleasure is gained, how much pain is reduced. In other words, the end justifies the means. We've all heard that before, I'm sure. So whatever sacrifice needs to be made for the greater good is morally acceptable. Whatever we need to do to build up that group in a positive way is good, because the value of an individual lies in his usefulness as part of that larger group. Now, we see utilitarianism literally everywhere in our culture, but I want to look at what this looks like, particularly in the pro-life movement. Now, utilitarianism is at the heart, really, of any abortion law that makes exceptions for certain humans in order to gain incremental progress, whether they have an extra chromosome, whether they are conceived in rape, have a bleak prognosis, or they are physically disabled. Utilitarianism also perverts our free will, right? It entices us emotionally with things like... it entices us emotionally with things like fairness, things like justice, things like equality, things that will convince us to prevent suffering. So as a consequence, though, we're granted selective rights by our government instead of the inalienable rights that are now rejected that come from our Creator. And our value is actually shifted from being made in the image of God to being used as part of the group. So as I was saying, utilitarianism is at the heart of any abortion law that makes exceptions for certain humans. The problem is, though, that when we sacrifice the one to save the 99, instead of going back and saving that one, we are embracing utilitarianism. We are saying we want the greatest good for the greatest number. And really what happens is these children become a useful part of a political strategy instead of a reason for a moral one. But we also see utilitarianism in the Beethoven argument. Now, this is interesting. You may have heard about this. The scenario is there's a man that has syphilis and his pregnant wife has tuberculosis. One of their children has already died. Three have terminal illnesses. So the conditions are such that for this family, abortion seems like a compassionate act, except the problem is the unborn child is Beethoven. Because Beethoven's mother chooses life, then the world, the society is blessed with one of the greatest composers of all time. Now, this seems like a great pro-life argument, right? Who wouldn't want to save Beethoven? Who wouldn't want to save the baby that grows up to cure cancer? But the problem is, this is also utilitarian, because the value lies in the contribution that that individual is making to society. Value is not in his inherent worth as a human being made in the image of God. It is not in his God-given purpose, whether that's to transform the world through music, to cure cancer, or not. But I think even more subtly, what this argument does is it wrestles with the notion that the world's view of compassion competes with God-given purpose. So in some circumstances, sometimes it's okay to take life, to prevent suffering, as long as the motivation is love. So this leads me to transition from utilitarianism to actually the misinterpretation of Scripture that I want to talk about. And this misinterpretation is situation ethics. Here, morality is individualistic, and each person forms his or her own belief system and measures that behavior against that subjective moral framework. Like in utilitarianism, we see this rejection of absolute truth once again. Moral relativism really has been around, I guess you could say, for thousands of years in philosophy. We can trace it way back, and it certainly has driven the secularization or the de-Christianization of America, but its twin, situation ethics, actually came from inside the church in the 1960s by a man named Joseph Fletcher. Now, Fletcher was an Episcopal priest. He was a leading academic proponent of eugenics. He is also considered the patriarch of bioethics, which, as some of you know, are a set of principles that underlie modern medical research that are based on eugenics. Fletcher taught that the only absolute is love. So God is love, love your neighbor, love conquers all, the greatest of these is love. It seems like a really solid doctrine until you start to peel back the surface, because what Fletcher was claiming was that any biblical commandment can be broken in good conscience as long as the motivation is love. But this theory does not address how different people subjectively define love in different situations. And because love is subjectively defined, then man actually replaces God. We replace God as the moral sovereign, even as the grantor of justice and mercy. This also ignores the biblical view that man is void of sufficient wisdom to manage his own moral affairs by himself, right? It assumes that a person is always able to predict in advance the most loving course of action, given the short and long-term consequences of that action. And of course, as we know, that is impossible for us to do. We are not God. So what does this look like in the pro-life movement specifically? Well, we concede to situation ethics when we concede to compassion arguments for abortion. We see this very often in cases of rape. We see it in cases of fetal anomaly. But we also see it in cases where children are going to be born into poverty or neglect or abuse, right? The slope is slippery. Whatever we bring in, whatever in the name of compassion and love is morally right. Compassion arguments work so well that the abortion advocates have actually birthed an entire strategy just on the compassion argument. And in fact, major parts of the church, very large parts of the church, have come out in support of abortion because of the compassion arguments. And if you look at the history of the decriminalization of abortion, you will find the church right there cheerleading, cheering on abortion because of compassion. But the problem is, to kill or to prevent suffering out of love is to completely ignore the biblical sanctity of life ethic that is woven throughout the Bible, and instead favor a corrupted, twisted view of compassion. These are the people that work in the abortion industry. These are the abortionists. They have compassion. They have it. But it's twisted. It's not based on a biblical foundation. It's wrong. The truth is, abortion is never love. It is never love. And in fact, it prevents love, it prevents hope, and it prevents purpose. So as we go forward as individuals, as participants, as movers, as shapers, as leaders in the 21st century pro-life movement, we need to remember our calling. We need to remember that we are sent out into the darkness to rescue people from the darkness by our stance on truth, by that solid biblical foundation. Romans 12:2 says, "Do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind." There's the education piece. There's the awareness. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will. There's that recognition in the culture, that awakening that starts to happen. Well, once we do that, then there's that rejection that I talked about. See to it that no one takes you captive through hollow and deceptive philosophy. There it is, which depends on human tradition and the elemental spiritual forces of this world rather than on Christ. Well, I love it when the Bible is so clear about exactly what we are supposed to do. And finally, have nothing to do with the fruitless deeds of darkness, but rather expose them. Expose them. So I'm going to end now just by talking for just a minute about my organization. We actually provide the educational tools for this exposure to happen. So we help prepare people for that rejection of the things that are of the world and that embracing of the principled way forward. This is the principled way forward. It just needs to be applied consistently across all issues, across all legislation. We just need to step up. We need to go out into the world to rescue by standing on a solid foundation of the word. So we help you do that. So I would encourage you to learn more about our organization. I have some things in the back. You can go to our homepage. If you scroll down at the bottom of our homepage, our course catalog is there. We have a free 10-minute course that'll give you a really good introduction into our Rise Up in the Truth curriculum. And this curriculum goes decade by decade through these philosophies. We track that thread. We see how it's woven. We see how America is broken down. And we help you understand how to move forward in a principled way. So take a flyer about us in the back. There's also an offer there. If you're a leader or a pastor or a priest in your church or a leader in your organization, I have an offer back there for you to help get you involved with us and so we can connect with you. With that, I think I will turn it over. Thank you.
I cannot encourage you enough to look into Sarah's programs. They are life-changing. They really are. For those of you that are in education, please contact Sarah. She has got the most incredible organization, and she is doing amazing things, really solid, amazing things. So please grab her stuff from the back and then contact her, and she's great. She's often on my show, bringing from the media. I'm getting them all mixed up. From the media, and so listen to her often when she's bringing in a new piece of her curriculum. I'll have her back on the show, and that's always up on our website, fromthemedian.org. I've got a couple of questions for the two of you. Thank you both. This is just amazing. Absolutely. We're so honored to have you both here with us. The first question is, does the legislation that would make the Hyde Amendment permanent have a rape exception? Dan, I will ask you. You can go to the...
Can anybody answer that question?
The Hyde Amendment is the prohibition on Medicaid funding of abortion, and it has always had exceptions for rape, incest, life of the mother. What the Trump administration did for the first time is to make that funding prohibition permanent. So, yes, we'd rather not have exceptions in the Hyde Amendment. But it's pretty effective in preventing the funding of abortion. But just on principle, you don't want those exceptions carved into our law. Codified in law, because it's a patent denial of equal protection under the law.
Historically, going way back, the Southern Baptist Convention was in favor of abortion. The Catholic bishops' plan would not allow for rape and incest exceptions in the early movement itself. It wasn't until the Hyde Amendment came along, which did not have rape and incest exceptions, iteration, until one day, I believe, I forget the exact date, it included rape and incest exceptions for the first time. and the Catholic bishops jumped on board, and the Baptists jumped off. We're hoping for a time in which we're together in one mind to be able to oppose all funding of abortion through our tax dollars. So thank you, Matt. Sandy of Personhood, Wisconsin, of Pro-Life, Wisconsin, one of our members.
The next question is, the third exception and the basis of Doe versus Bolton is in cases where the life of the mother is endangered. How do the Personhood Alliance and Speak Life address this issue?
So we're talking specifically about life of the mother. I'm going to be a little dangerous here and say that life of the mother is a bit of a misnomer, because there really is no situation that abortion saves the life of the mother. Particularly as you get into later trimesters, what happens is if there is an acute medical crisis with the mother, that doctor will try to save both. It does absolutely no good to try an abortion which takes place over 2-3 days. That mother's going to die from abortion. So abortion, its goal as a medical procedure, and I have to say that as I explain, its goal is to take life intentionally. So in any time that you're trying to save the life of the mother, you're never going in to take life intentionally. You are trying to save the mother at the same time that you are trying to save her baby. The goal of that is not to kill. It is to try to save both. So I hope that clarifies what we mean by there is really no life of the mother. It's an exception that came really at the beginning of the legalization of abortion. It's one that was put forth even in the 1930s as we really saw more concerted efforts to try to push legalization. It's one that's hung on, and it was the impetus for legalization, and it is one of those things that is keeping it legal, which all exceptions do. They came in, and they're forbidding us to go out. That's what exceptions are.
Do you know that no rape and incest exception ever put into any state law has ever been gone back and removed? That's a true statement right now. Isn't that an amazing fact? You hear from the politicians, we're going to put them in, and we're going to come back, and we're going to clean it up. Clean bills are what we're after. Bills that support the sanctity of life without doing harm. The life of the mother exception can be effectively written into law with the exact definition of what Sarah just said. But so often it is not. So when you're examining your bills, be very careful about how it's worded. And somebody that's taken the lead on this nationally has been Pro-Life Wisconsin, training their legislature exactly how to frame that into protective statute. So be very clear when you examine your statutes. Matt?
And following what Dan said, often the life of the mother exception is shrouded in a medical emergency exception, so you really have to dive into that language and look at what how they're defining it and how they're describing it. So,
I want to piggyback off of that. I'm glad you said that, because the life of the mother was what Doe v. Bolton did, the companion case to Roe v. Wade, decided on the same day. What it did is said that the life of the mother is broad. So mental health, age, familial health, it broadened it so widely that is now the big giant loophole, that if we leave that in, although there is a motive to be compassionate, right? If there's a medical emergency, really the definition has already, it's already there. It was defined in Doe, and that case gave us abortion on demand. So it's important to make that distinction.
Absolutely, and I think that's something that we've been trying to push here in Cleveland Right to Life, is the understanding of that, because it gets very murky, particularly for women who have faced, you know, severe problems during a pregnancy, And what I always come back to is the fact that the goal of the physician is to try all in everything in their power to save both lives. That's what it's about. It's not about going in and saying, oh, you got a problem. Okay, let's take the baby away and then we'll see what happens after that. That's exactly what where we've come to, though. So there's a real problem with that. Okay, final question. Let me put this down and grab this. I've got too many things in my hand. I'm trying. Is the only problem with utilitarianism that God is removed or rejected? In the most general understood sense, the individual good is only qualified by the greatest good.
So I think if I understand the question, what we're really getting at is the idea of individualism versus collectivism. And collectivism, what it does is it goes after the intimate relationship that each human being has with his or her creator. And any philosophy that tries to drive a wedge in that, that comes in the middle of that, is going to be a problem. So there are myriad problems with collectivism. It obviously was the basis for communism. It's the basis for socialism, Marxism. But it is also the basis for really the enemy's plan to destroy God's plan of redemption of man. After the fall, we were separated. We were separated from him, and he's drawing us back all the time. And anytime the devil can get in there with whatever, whether it's a philosophy, whether it's a thing, something material in the world, he wants to keep us separated. And so I think when you really break it all down, and the root of utilitarianism or any philosophy that goes up against absolute truth really is trying to separate you from your creator. I hope that answers the question.
My understanding of the question was that if you take, is it just taking God out of the equation? Isn't there some good that comes even apart from God? We destroy the power that could be ours in our movement when we separate it from our faith-based element. And I've shared with you some amazing results that have been turned in by groups who have returned to first principles and their faith-based approach, including God into the equation, particularly relying upon God to accomplish things that you couldn't do through your political, pragmatic, planning, strategy, political action. I was 17 years as a political action director. I understand political pragmatism. I understand empirical data. You want to see empirical data? We took it from Georgia to National Right to Life, and they admitted they had not seen that kind of a response anywhere. Now, could we claim that it was due to our brilliance or our amazing execution or our financing? No, not at all. There were miracles that took place in the political realm, in the hearts of people. Ideas impacted individual decision makers, men of power, women of power, that we can't claim. We can't claim. You want to give up that aspect just to continue a pragmatic attempt apart from God? I think not. I think that's one of the challenges that we need and hurdles we need to get over and return back to our faith.
I just want to add to that, that blessing comes from obedience. Blessing comes from obedience. So when we are obedient, God will pour out in abundance more than we can ever think or imagine. And if we will stand true, then we have no idea the impact that we can have on this nation and on the world. You heard in Africa, we have a hand in that. We have influence as Americans in that, and it feels really far away, but it's not. It's all the same root. It's the same people, even. It's really easy to trace. And I think that once we can sort of set our feet and be okay with that and be empowered by God, then we just have no idea what he's going to do.
You've been listening to Dan Becker and Sarah Qualley's presentation at the 2017 Bringing America Back to Life Convention.